The thing about personality, like I have been told by people that I have a strong personality, and that has been a criticism of me, you know, a criticism that, like, I come on too strong or something like that. And, you know, what it does to me is make me, makes me try to act more womanly and weak.
Yeah, I feel the same way, too. I've been in this situation where I've been called on for being, quote, too sure of myself, unquote. And it's really strange, but I've, you know, like, no one has ever told me before I got into the women's movement, you know, in a negative way, you're too sure of yourself, it's very bad, I'm intimidated by you. And so when someone like ourselves come in, you know, and we, you know, and we strut in instead of slink in or something like that, and they say, well, you're too sure of yourself, to me, that's really an indication of, you know, like, back down, you know, you're being too strong. And never in my life have I ever, you know, thought of that as being negative. And, you know, and so, and I realized that they have to start being able to deal with all forms of personalities as well as we do.
But isn't just dealing with all forms of personality, but that kind of hypocritical front, whether it's a movement front of tender vibes and sisterhood, or a Bethesda mother's front of all's well with the world and I've got a new Saint Laurent suit, it doesn't matter, it's still a front. And they're attempting to control us by making us act like them. And the point is, they're not saying, you know, that people get pissed off all the time. Now, when they get pissed off, they get you under the table, you know.
Yeah.
They smile at you, and then as soon as you walk out, they turn to their friend and they say, you know, that Karen just has so much residual hostility. I feel that she's an intensely negative and self-destructive person. You know, you got it. Yeah.
That label of being negative or creating tension. Mm-hmm. You're always creating tension, and I think that's an important difference too. There's, you know, tension is what motivates me. You know, it's what makes me go. It's one of the things, you know, it's part of struggle because, you know, that's how I view life as a struggle. That's why it's worth doing at all, you know. But for them, that's negative, see, because the norm for them is smoothness, calmness.
Moderation.
Yes, moderation. Everything, you know, in its place kind of thing. And for me, it's movement, it's change. And that means tension, and that means struggle, and that means forces, you know.
And excitement and passion.
Right.
And chances and risk.
Mm-hmm. And that's why you come into a room and you talk loud and you're full of force and people shrivel, you know. And the interesting thing is, though, you know, the question I have is, you know, I would hope that would inspire people. Why does it have the effect of not doing that? Instead, it makes them feel intimidated and guilty. I think maybe that's just because the pace has been so set that we've got to now come in and say, look, we're going to change the pace. You know, we've got something to do. I think it has to do with the urgency with which people feel something has to be done. And that, you know, we've got to instill that urgency of the need for something to be done. The time, you know, has long passed that we've spent enough time talking. And if that sense of urgency is there, then people won't be run away from, you know, the strength and force of, you know, a personality that's in, you know, feels the need to do something.
Guilt is also a way to control people. Because if somebody's sitting there feeling guilty, you're supposed to feel sorry for them, right? Guilt is an excuse for irresponsibility. If you're feeling guilty, you won't act because you're going to say, gee, I'm afraid what I'll do is the wrong thing. So you can sit on your ass and feel guilty for years, and you get pity points. You know, as far as I'm concerned, guilt is the most worthless emotion ever developed. I think I've only felt guilty once, and that's because I got caught when I hit somebody, you know, when I was a little kid. Guilt just isn't part of my makeup. I don't feel guilty about anything. If something's wrong, and if I know I've been wrong, then I'm going to change it. I'm not going to sit there and feel guilty about it, for Christ's sake.
It's guilt is a totally meaningless feeling, whereas I know that I feel responsible a whole lot, and there's a difference because I don't respond with guilt. I respond with feeling responsible, and then I have to do something about it. You know, and that's linked with accountability. Where guilt has no accountability.
Yeah.
There's no need to feel that you have to do anything about it. All you have to do is sit there and wallow in the emotion. You know.
Well, I think we should talk about that some, because I have gotten caught in the guilt thing, and maybe it's because I'm Catholic.
Well, it has also, though, very deeply to do with women oppression and the fact that women so often, throughout their lives, are always made to feel, it's this borderline of responsibility and guilt, because most of the time women aren't responsible for something that goes wrong. If their kid, fucks up and winds up in jail or doesn't do well in school, what does the mother feel? She feels guilt, but she's not really responsible. And this is the whole woman thing, that the mother woman is somehow always, it's always thrown back to her. So it has some ground in not only in class but in general woman oppression, and why I think in some senses that it cuts across class lines, but it's very prevalent in the middle class, particularly.
Well, it's also the whole emotional aspect, of women too. Instead of thinking things out rationally, instead of getting all guilty about something, you go out and fix it up, like what Rhea said, what you were talking about, being accountable. And whereas a lot of times, if you're slower in moving towards action, stuff like that, and then you stay at the level of the emotional part. And, of course, that has a lot to do with, being female.
It's interesting. One of the things you said in opening the show was personality. And for us, we ought to try to find ways to unravel how our personalities are connected with being women coming from the lower classes. For instance, where I came from, it was the women who were the strong people. Mm-hmm. The men were the weaklings. I remember, of course, being a child and listening to my mother talk to her friends. And, her whole outlook on life was, it's our job to make the men behave, because they'll get drunk if we don't. Yeah. They'll spend the money unwisely. We are responsible for everything, is essentially what she was saying. And I picked that up. And I think perhaps it's reversed in a middle-class home, so that my models and the people I wanted to be were women. Yeah. I wanted to be like my mother.
Yeah. Right, that's an important point, because I had that experience too, and it was like the men, I really think the men were like brothers, to me. I've mentioned this before, but the women were the ones that I identified with, and I sometimes think it's not so much you identify with sex as you identify with strength.
Like probably the same person that might be intimidated by me or talk about me would say, but how do you do it? What makes you strong? And I always say, it's probably, because I've gone through, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and my mother, because, that always what stands out in my mind. And, in the urban areas with lower class, especially the welfare areas, you usually have the female-dominated communities. The man has left. Or you have the men that are just out on the street that are, that aren't really related to the immediate families that you're all working around. And so you do see the responsibility. And I always heard my mother time and time again talking about the no good men. Go out and have a good time, mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean, plus you also had a lot of lesbian porno too.
Well,
that's the thing I think that hasn't
been brought up, but it is the thing that there is a lot less illusion about men in the lower classes and the working classes.
There's
and
there's,
I mean, there's not that mystification, right.
And still to this day, my mother, her major lesson of her life is never trust a man, mm-hmm. never depend on a man. They're irresponsible. Mm-hmm. They can't do anything.
The children.
And being in the women's movement for the last 3 years and, seeing man-hating as a certain phenomenon within the women's movement, and then going home, and you could say that what's going on there is man-hating. But it's not. It's not of the same nature.
Right.
It's a real understanding of the limitations of men,
mm-hmm.
and knowing what they can't do and what they're not capable of. And so you don't put all your energies into hating for them for that. All your energies go into doing
making
what has to be done, yeah, and surviving. And it's interesting that the whole man-hating phenomena has come out of middle-class women
who haven't experienced.
Else.
And their structures of strength are the men, and so that's how they're dealing with the strength in a lot of ways, is by rejecting the men and hating the men and putting their energies in there without being accountable for getting the things done, because they still are powerless in that respect.
For us, women, we saw strong women. We were part of that thing of growing up with that, But it's like there's something a little bit fishy to me and strange about having to go back 200 years or 100 years to dig up somebody,
we're right here, right?
It doesn't really fit me. I've tried it on, tried to get into it, but anyway,
I mean, talking about it, it's clear to me that I have had models. My mother is a matriarch, a wonderful model of strength, you know, and I appreciate her. And I have aunts that have been that way, you know, and I don't think they'll ever be famous, you know, but...
I can remember spending a lot of time in the movement trying to get into how was I brainwashed as a child to adapt to the female role. And I can, you know, it's not until recently that I figured out I never was.
Yeah.
You know, I never in my family situation, you know, and then for a while I attributed that to being, well, I was the oldest, so therefore, you know, I was, you know, treated more not even as a male, as just, you know, you're treated as a person. You've got to do your thing. You got to do your share. But it's interesting that practically everything the movement wrote dwelled on how we are conditioned to be a certain role. But that was not my experience, and it took me a long time to even, you know, realize that, you know, that wasn't my experience. You know, I mean, the movement has that effect of making you, you know, think that you're just like everybody else, the whole woman thing.
Is it really?
It's a different way of thinking of yourself that didn't fit for you either. You know, it was a way of, you know, feeling sorry for yourself, poor me, or something like that, you know, when you didn't need to do that.
Well, my mama told me self-pity stinks. And that's what the women's movement is, just wallowing in. It's because their survival needs were met. So the only oppression that they could understand was psychological. And as they were the people with access to the media, that's what got transmitted, which is this whole a psychological analysis of why you're oppressed as a woman. That applies only partially to us. I mean, we had strong women that we identified with, our mothers. That's just what we were talking about. But we were brought up differently than the men where we came from. There's no doubt about that. But we don't have that kind of psychological approach. We're not going to sit and wail and moan and say, Jesus, I'm trapped by my ovaries, you know? That's just not the way we look at the world. We are the politicians in the movement. We are the people who understand power and politics and money, you know? And you can't have a political movement without that, because we look at women's oppression in survival terms, because that's how we look at the world. I mean... The psychological thing just washes over us or irritates us or becomes amusing or irritating. And that one of the things we have to learn, though, is that it's real for those women. But they've got to get out of it. They've got to go beyond it. And they're not. I know people who are still in their goddamn consciousness-raising group after 5 years.
Now, that leads right in back into the leadership thing. And, you know, and that's why, you know, the leadership is coming from women who, you know, they see it in political terms, and the resistance to the leadership is coming from those who see it in psychological terms. And, you know, and the question again is the link between the two and how we create that link. One of the mechanisms that why I worked so hard on creating something like a women's center was because I think that's a mechanism that, you know, middle-class women, women who are concerned with psychological oppression, if they can commit themselves to that and get involved in that, they'll see the futility in something like that. It will become a survival question for them. One, because either that institution or whatever won't be able to survive because the system won't let it survive because it's not going to give it money. Or they're going to see that it doesn't solve the problems, that the problems are deeper than that, that they're only trying on individual solutions and psychological kind of solutions. And so I think that those, you know, those kind of activities for middle-class women can maybe bring about the change. But I think it's also necessary that people be around, you know, people like us, always reminding them of the need for the politics, because I think they can go on for a long time without realizing, you know, they can realize that something isn't happening and something isn't right and that this is a futile activity, but they can't see what the answer is. And that's why the presence of other people, or at least, you know, producing writing right now, I think is really important, that they can realize that there's other alternatives in what they are, because sometimes, you know, maybe they can't see it within the scope that they're in.
Lower class women had initiated this movement, and it was, you know, that those were the dominant kind of values. You know, we wouldn't be thinking about models as much, you know.
Oh, we'd have a whole different movement.
Yeah, it would be a whole different movement.
We wouldn't have things like abortion counseling. We wouldn't have things like women's centers. We would probably, well, we would already have political organizations that would, you know, had grassroots, probably involved in community organizations that already exist. You know, it would be an entirely different movement. Now we've got to, I'm not sure sometimes whether we're going backwards, you know, or whether we're just going a different way. I don't know. But I think that both can happen at the same time. There's no reason why the organizing couldn't be going on right now among lower and working class people at a whole different level than what, you know, totally outside of women's centers and existing women's movement organizations. And that's up to people like us and other people who right now can't, you know, can't get into what the women's movement is doing. And, you know, there's nothing, you know, what is now defined as the women's movement is not all that there can be. And you know, we have to have a broader scope than that.
This week, we're discussing for Radio Free Women the concept of leadership and how we see it in terms of women and our class background and how that's, you know, how that's going to be perceived outside of the women's movement, as well as what's been going on in terms of leadership within the women's movement. And also another thing that we think that's really important that goes hand in hand with leadership is group identity. Some of the common elements is a lot of women in the women's movement, whenever they see a woman who's strong and takes responsibility and is an accountable leader, they call it a male thing because they're used to having men in power, in positions of power, and that, you know, so it's an immediate stereotyping. And as we all know, anyone that's experienced any part of the women's movement, there's a general tendency for the equalization of all women. And so that means trying to pull up the women that are, like, slower to achieve certain types of politics and to bring down the women that are, you know, ahead of others and just make everybody on the same level. And we know that that's not true. So we wanted to talk about, you know, like, specifically what's been going on with this and what we see as being important.
This thing about group identity that comes down so heavy on class and gets acted out in leadership is that in middle-class homes, to the best of my understanding, the people are separated from each other and individualized. And they go to schools and they compete with each other for good grades because they all try to get into schools. And the only model for teamwork is something like football. And for women, there's absolutely no model for teamwork in schools at all. And so they understand leadership only in sort of star-tripping terms. One individual who achieves competing against all the others and winning, then that's somebody who gets assigned as a leader. That's how they conceive of leadership. And they don't understand the other kind, the real, true leadership, which I think comes more out of where we all come from in the lower classes, where you have people who must hang together for physical survival, so that you can't go competing against each other in the ways in which middle-class people do. You all have your jobs, and you come back and you bring the money, and the money's divided up, and people are valued for their various skills. But the skills are all put in the service of the survival of the unit that you're living in, which is usually the family.
Another thing about individualism and about how middle-class people are raised with what Rita said, that they are raised to be individuals and competing against each other. And then when they come into the women's movement and they talk about personal change and, you know, sisterhood and all this, then they adopt the whole new thing of conformity. So it's kind of like, you know, they're going from individualism, you know, to a conforming type situation. And then anybody that isn't like them, you know, they label as, you know, external or... And then a lot of people, though, are always objectified from the lower classes, you know, into being one solid mass, but yet we are all, like, strong individuals. And we haven't lost the perception of the group identity. And so we're also trying to get out of the conformity. We're trying to show what we have to offer as an individual, and that is, you know, this amorphous mass. And so it's kind of like a, you know, a conflict of sorts between, you know, those two concepts.
Well, it's more than a conflict. The point is the middle-class women are still making the rules.
Because there's more of them. And they don't understand what real leadership is. and they don't understand yet what it means to work together. So when somebody does what I think you're talking about, which is strong and pushes forward, it's frightening to them because their associations with it in their lives have been damaging, which isn't what we're going to do. The point really is trust. They don't understand our lives. They don't understand who we are. They won't even listen to us. They don't trust us. And if they can't even listen to the truth about our own lives, it's no wonder that they treat us the way they do when we really exert our leadership.
There's something coming out of the way that leadership has been approached as almost something out of mass society, whereas I think some of it comes from competition, because maybe they're afraid of competition from each other, that they all have to duplicate and be the same and be like each other. That there have been controls in a way that I think it's got something to do with the competition, in that none of us go ahead unless all of us go ahead, which is unrealistic. And it doesn't really take into account that there is diversity within the movement. I mean, it's like a paralysis of the movement in that area. And it goes back to the thing about being male. That's where the definition, anything at all that's male, you know, even if it's within a female body, is bad, you know. That's the morality, you know. And it isn't recognized that women coming from lower classes are more male in the sense that you've had to be more aggressive to survive. You've had to take more initiative.
Well, yeah, maybe it's not necessarily male. It's just what is necessary to survive.
In class,
right.
Terms.
And, yeah, mm-hmm. In class terms. They've had to act. And as you said, you know, when somebody has to do something, you see that something has to be done and you do it.
Right.
And if you do that within the women's movement, you're condemned because you haven't confined in your actions to the collective body of all present, and, you know, until everything is so worked out that nothing happens. And it goes back to what we've discussed in earlier shows, and that ability to act, which most middle-class women don't have. They have to discuss it for years before they can act on it. The leadership comes out of those who take action, who make decisions, mm-hmm. and then act on those decisions.
Can I pick up on something that Dolores said, which might clarify this for listeners? We were talking about group identity in lower-class homes, right? And how you had to act. You were responsible for your own self at a much earlier age than the other people, than the middle class women. So that you do have this ability to make things happen. You know how to go out in the world and hustle. There's no other word for it, because you got to hustle to survive where we come from. The point is that now that could be confusing to somebody listening to the show who's from the middle class, because it sounds like we're saying we're strong individual women, but we have a group identity. They're not going to understand that. And I think if I can make this clear for them. What happens in the homes where we come from, and it should be recognized that the lower class isn't as homogenous as the middle class. Mm-hmm. An Italian lower class home is different than white trash, is different than a black lower class home, is different than a Polish lower class home, because the ethnic culture is still strong, and it differs from each other, although money values are pretty much the same. But what we do, which is so terrific and which I really want to bring to the movement, which I think we have to teach these people, I mean, and I really mean teach, too, and I'll take the responsibility for that word, is that we develop different skills so that we were individuals, and within that family, we were recognized as individuals. It was thought of as eccentricities, or like my mother would say if my father did something, well, that's just his way. But there was a lot of allowance made for who he was as a person and what he could do as well as what he couldn't do. And you took everybody with what they could do and you put them together, and that was your unit. So that you had a group identity, because we all worked for the same goal, survival. That was our damn goal. There was no other goal. But we were different, and it was terrific, and people got off on it, you know? And that's exactly what the movement lacks right now, because middle-class women don't understand that differentness. They see difference as hostility, as opposition, as enemy, instead of as skill, which you feed into a common goal, because they never lived it.
A woman, maybe who doesn't have university credentials or something like that, is not the authority, you know. I mean, there's resistance to that as teaching. You know, that life experience alone, you know, the person off the street, you know, who's had life experience, you know,
unless like they have some sort of status that goes along with it, there's a resistance on the part of middle class people to accept that and to listen to that skill.
I don't know about that though, Dolores. I have a tendency, because I've heard it harped over and over again, if you start to politicize something within the women's movement, if you start to put a political analysis on something, I've encountered resistance to that, and the resistance always comes in the form of saying, you're not talking out of your personal experience. And I think there's been a tendency to dwell on the personal experience and not go beyond that. But the problem is not that they don't want to listen to personal experience, they only want to listen to middle class personal experience. It's the only kind they can relate to.
Right.
That other personal experience is so far outside their realm.
Well, in my experience, the only way it's really acceptable is if you're being funny about it.
Well, that gets back to trust also, which is another thing that was mentioned, and I'd like to kind of follow that through. And I think that the lack of trust comes from the fact that middle-class women, and you know, obviously that's the makeup of the women's movement, unfortunately, never had like strong, you know, like model structures of strength by women, and you know, like, and it was basically the strength that they saw was, you know, the men in power positions and everything, and even their whole perception of strength was very narrowly defined. And they say, well, who are you going to be accountable to? Leaders have to be accountable. And I feel as if we're accountable all the time, you know, because we can't ever forget what we're fighting for, you know. And I think if you come out of a survival struggle, you're always going to be accountable, and you're always going to, you know, have clear visions of what's going on, and that you will never have to say, I've lost who I'm, you know, fighting for. And they just really can't understand that, because I don't think they have anybody that they're accountable to, and they're not even accountable to themselves, because it gets back to the whole idea that they won't accept the concept of strength as we're presenting and work out from the model structures and gain self-confidence, so that, you know, the first person you've got to be accountable to is yourself, and then it goes on beyond that.
I'd like to pick up on something that I thought wasn't mentioned, but you sort of went around it when you were talking earlier, Rita, that relates to trust and the group identity, and that's a sense of loyalty.
Yeah.
And that loyalty is, you know, it's all a part of that group identity, and it's very threatening to middle class women. You know, they can't deal with that kind of, you know, commitment, and it's, you know, and it's something that is so integral to, you know, once you have a group identity, that's where your loyalty is, and it's strong, and it gives you strength.
Most of the middle-class women I know, and I'll speak about the women in the city that I've worked with and lived with, they won't take a chance until they do, as you said, they think it through. I mean, they make an orgy of judging and fence-sitting, and then they only decide if they think they're going to get something. And we had to take chances time and time again, not knowing what was on the other side. That's the whole point of growth or moving or getting anywhere. You don't really know. You act. You know, you think about it some ahead of time. I mean, I don't think you were suggesting that you just go out and impulsively do whatever comes into your head. You do think about it. But I think we're much quicker to size up a situation, and then we move our asses on it. And you don't always know what's going to happen. That's the whole point of life. They want to know 10 years ahead of time what's going to happen to them. And I think what we know, and it's really paradoxical, Dolores and I were talking about this the other night, is what we know and what the upper classes know is that you're never going to know. There's no security in this life. None. There's opportunity. That's all there is.
It kind of like confines their whole perception of reality into a moderation of society or something. Everything is, you know, the same level. Just like in collectives, they want all the women to be equal, and all women are sisters, and all this and all this. They have to plan their lives out on a certain scale.
Yeah,
and they
talk more specifically about that too,
go
because
into
the thing with the group, I think that they're really in the group identity thing, that there really is a difference in our orientations to the group, because like mainly the middle class is into control a lot, you know. And when you come from a lower class, you know, the first thing that you learn to control, I think, is yourself. You know, control yourself in a way so you get what you want or you survive.
The questions, you know, we've thrown out all the problems. We've we've presented everything that creates stumbling blocks to development of leadership within the movement. Now the question is, what can we do to be able to, you know, for leadership to develop and to be able to, you know, lead the movement to something? And I have some real doubts as to whether within the movement, as it presently is, a middle-class movement, whether leadership can be developed. Leadership has been killed and destroyed over and over again within the women's movement. And, you know, what's happened is that leadership has, you know, gone outside of what are the tight, you know, internal organs of the women's movement. And I don't consider myself to have left the women's movement, but I've certainly gotten outside of and pushed out of the integral things that are happening in this city in terms of, you know, what most people consider to be the women's movement. And so I sort of feel like my task now is to develop that leadership and a concept of leadership that's going to be much broader than what you can do within these small groups, and that we, you know, that perhaps now that those people who, you know, I'm tired of arguing with people about the need for leadership. So I want to talk with other people who already accept the need for leadership and begin to define, okay, how are we going to create it? How's it going to work? And what are we going to do with it? And then I think, you know, well, it, you know, what will happen is that leadership will go back and, you know, and we'll pick up all those people that have been so resistant all along, because they'll see the truth, because that's, you know, that's what we'll be presenting.
We haven't even really touched on the whole perception of leadership and strength and how that's viewed outside of the women's movement, and, you know, because they need to see, you know, figures of strength. They don't like to, you know, like, they know that they have to make decisions all the time, and they want everybody else to be able to do the same thing, too. We have to start crossing these lines, and I think, you know, in conclusion, to, you know, some of the things that we've brought up, I agree, too, it is kind of pessimistic, but we should start, you know, hopefully dealing with class seriously, you know, within the women's movement, seeing it as a priority. If we want, you know, to do a lot of effective political organizing and deal with the whole idea of model structures of strength and what that means.
But I don't think they're going to learn anymore by ripping off our energy. Yeah. And that our decision has got to be not a rejection of them, but regrouping among ourselves and acting, because that's what we do best. And as we produce that action, and as they see what we're doing, those of them that really care about women, that really care about change, they're going to change.
And I expect that those of them that really care will be, there are lower class women in the movement and working class women within the movement already, keeping very silent.
Yeah.
And more of those will come out, I think.
Yeah.
But the point I'm trying to make is that I have faith in women. I don't care where they come from. And if it takes those women at, you know, who are now stepping on our necks longer, okay, I think they'll change because they have to. It won't be a moral decision. I'm not a Pollyanna. It'll be a survival decision. When they understand their ass is really on the line, then they're going to have to see what we've done and come along.